listening to KRUU 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. And this is Writers' Voices. I'm Shemaine Montana, hosting today with Caroline Kilborn. Good afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon. It's a beautiful, beautiful day today.
It is. We are really lucking out.
We have lucked out.
Winter.
I know winter's coming, but it isn't here yet. I haven't broken out my winter coat yet, so
and
it's not here
yet. We're counting our blessings.
Yes, we are.
And happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Yes, indeed. Lovely day yesterday. A little cloudy yesterday, but it was still no snow. That's the important thing.
Well, today we're talking with Dr. Daniels, a clinical professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford Medical School. He is the co-author of The Essential Enneagram, along with Virginia Price. David Daniels has taught the Enneagram system at Stanford University and internationally for 15 years, and in private practice for more than 3 decades. Dr. Daniels is a founding director of the International Enneagram Association and served as a co-founder of the first International Enneagram Conference at Stanford University in August in 1994. The newly re-released version of The Essential Enneagram is being called the most fundamental guide to the Enneagram ever offered. Daniels and Price provide step-by-step instructions for self-analysis into how we think, feel, and experience life situations to determine our type. Daniels and Price then guide us to discover what our type means for our personal well-being and our relationships with others. Brimming with empowering information for each of the 9 types, this is a one-of-a-kind book that equips readers with all of the tools needed to dramatically enhance quality of life. The original 2000 release sold over 100,000 copies and was translated into over 10 languages.
Wow.
Yeah. So welcome, Dr. Daniels.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So why the re-release of this book? What's updated in this version?
Start with what the Enneagram is, because there's a lot of people out there that don't quite know it yet, because it's just below the radar of the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
But Enneagram is just simply from the Greek for Ennea, means 9. So Ennea is like 9 different personality styles, and gram means a figure. So it's like a 9-pointed star. You know, I like to say to people, if the Pentagon had just had 9 sides, everybody would know what an Enneagon is in the United States.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true.
Okay. Well, are there different schools of thought within the Enneagram system?
Well, yes, there are different, like in any field, like whether it's Christianity or whatever, there are different viewpoints that people have. But there's quite a bit of consensus about the fundamentals in the Enneagram system, mm-hmm. of these 9 styles of personality.
Mm-hmm. And where did the system come from?
Well, the system comes from, I believe, ultimately just from our evolution. When people say, well, why are there 9 styles? Why not 12 or 4 or 6? And I say, well, why are there just 17 species of penguins and not 20 or not 15 or whatever? It's just what evolution has given us. So in history it goes back, even in the mathematics, back to Pythagoras. The Christian fathers, the desert fathers in the 4th century A.D. had the 9 styles. But it was always below the kind of mainstream of things. So it has an ancient history that goes back for probably several thousand years, wherever people were doing reflection or meditation or prayer, when they could observe their own functions, their own habit of mind, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. How would you say that it compares with other personality typing systems?
Well, that's a great question. Thank you. First of all, it's about what the internal organization of our reality is, our internal organization. It's not about external behaviors per se. Most personality typologies do not have much predictive value because it's based upon a few external characteristics. So many of the types can have very similar external characteristics, but the internal motivation, the internal structure of reality is very different. So our whole process is to help people become more self-aware, self-discover what their type is, remembering that first of all they're human beings that just happen to have a personality type.
Mm-hmm. And then can you talk more about how it helps a person to find out what type they are?
Well, it's huge, actually. I've studied a lot of different things over the period of my career and life. I've been interested in human behavior since I was a child, basically. I can remember going up on the roof of our house when I was 11 years old at night and sneaking up there to watch the stars and wonder about what made everything work. Mm-hmm. So it's been a long interest to me, and I'd studied all kinds of personality and theories and everything from Jung to behavioralism, for example. When the Enneagram came along, it was so powerful because it's literally about the interwoven pattern of the way information and energy process up the neurons. The Enneagram is based upon these patterns of interwoven flow of information and energy. And each pattern is based upon an adaptive strategy that we develop as we're growing up.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about that. So does this mean when we're born, we're kind of a blank slate and our personalities develop through our experiences?
Well, that's a great question, too. The personality environment begins right at conception. That's a huge environment in utero. Mm-hmm. For 9 months, you're sharing the neuroendocrines, the neurotransmitters, the mother's mood, the rest of the family. When that infant is born, they totally recognize the mother. You can measure this physiologically. They recognize the other supports in the life. So there's already been a lot of environment going on. In studies we've done, it just comes back that it's both nature and nurture. There's both mm-hmm. temperament or hereditary factors that lead you toward a particular direction and also environmental things. And those combine together to form up the nine patterns.
Mm-hmm.
So we're anything but a tabula rasa when we're born. And mm-hmm. mothers tell me that have had more than one child, boy, they were different in utero, different amount of energy, amount of kicking, amount of resting, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. So the Enneagram system doesn't really separate out what part is nature, what part is nurture. It's just that the mystery reveals itself in a personality type that can be related to one of these nine types.
Right. They're just their leanings that come from temperament style toward, what direction you're going to go, and then the environment comes in and interacts and affects things right from the very beginning of conception.
Mm-hmm. The reason that
an intermingling of them.
The nature versus nurture story or question is important because if it's all nurture, if our personalities develop only because of our experiences and as stress coping mechanisms, then the goal would be to return to such a balanced personality that you couldn't be placed on the Enneagram.
Ultimately, that would still be the goal, although uh-huh. it's pretty hardwired in, these fundamental adaptive strategies that develop early in our life through this combination of temperament or genetics and our environmental experience. It's a lifespan typology. One of the things about the Enneagram is that's remarkable. We develop this early in childhood. It can be discerned often early in childhood and then goes on through life.
So
the deal is to become more free, more liberated. The Enneagram isn't about putting you in a box. It's about discovering the box you're in order to get out of the box. It's a liberation
right.
psychology.
Right.
It's so fundamental. Remember that the brain is literally a pattern machine. We have patterns for everything. Doorknobs, for example. What could you do in the United States if you didn't have a pattern for doorknobs? You wouldn't be able to get around.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this huge cortex, this huge brain, and it's a pattern machine. We have to have patterns in order to navigate around.
Mm-hmm. So the goal then is that once you figure out your type, you can learn about that type's strengths and weaknesses, and then you can learn what you need to do to balance yourself out to be more effective in the world. Is that right?
Remember, that's right, and remember that there's what's called neuroplasticity in the neurobiology field. We can learn new things. We can create new neurons, new connections. Remember that it starts out with almost 100 billion neurons, and many, many more of these dendrites or interconnections, and we can grow new ones. It doesn't matter about your age. So you can change the patterns,
mm-hmm.
and you can develop, and you can get more free of the limitations of your pattern.
Do you think many people want to do that? Or they just like to go along with where they are? What have you found in your research about that?
Yes, that's a dilemma for humankind. Is are we willing to go on the path of development? Because that always involves some challenge. All new learning creates a certain amount of stress.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The stress of life can be even huge. So it does help. It's amazing the way it can help relationships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not always fun to look at where you're not functioning well, but you have to do that if you want to improve.
Right.
Right. That's both. I mean, the Enneagram shows that we have, you know, great strengths in our style, and we also have some challenges in our style. So just to name one of the types, the what we call type one, the perfectionist, it's the type that came to believe that you have to be good and right in order to be loved and worthy in the world, to have the basic needs for love and worth and security met. So then you become very conscientious, responsible, improvement-oriented, self-controlled. Also be, you know, pretty critical because you've got this huge judging mind, resentful, and very much self-judging. This perfectionist style grows by helping to notice and reduce the dominance of the critical mind, that judging mind, and appreciate differences and as just error instead of something that's wrong with the other person or with yourself. And accept and integrate more about desire and instinct into your own life. When you do that, you get a lot of freedom.
Because we have inherited tendencies. I mean, we inherit personality tendencies, just like we inherit genes, or just like we inherit talents.
They understand this, too. They understand it's just a struggle for this person, you know, to try to make the world a better place, motivated to make improvements.
So are there opposite types where you look to learn what you need to balance in yourself? Or how?
Different types, nine strategies, and we all have, by the way, something of every type. If I had zero of whatever type you are, and you had zero of my type, you know, you'd be like a Martian or something to me, and vice versa. So we all have something of all the types. Have other connections within the Enneagram that influence our type structure. So there's a great deal of variability, but there's a fundamental, basic, adaptive strategy. Like in the perfectionist, when you believe you've got to be good and right, you've got to have high internal standards, and you've got to be out there improving the world and making improvements. You're just possessed by that when you're really owned by your type, and be very self-judging and judging of others. You need to release from that, become more self-accepting, more judgmental, more less judgmental, and more kind to yourself and to others. And you can do that through the process of self-observation and building awareness and, you know, what we call the universal growth process.
How can you talk more about that?
Well, we've developed something we call the universal growth process for self-mastery. The first step of that is building awareness. It's called 4 A's, and anybody can remember 4 A's. The first A is awareness, and it means building that self-observer, that inner witness, being able to come back and calm yourself into practice and to be more present and receptive, just breathing back and not being all filled with whatever is going on in the world out there for a few moments. Remember, when we breathe back and just follow the breath, we come back into the present moment, so we're not owned so much by everything going around us. So that receptivity, that receptive awareness is the first one. The second one is what we call acceptance, the second A. And that really just basically means non-judgment, kindness toward yourself and others. And when those two interweave, that awareness and that acceptance, that non-judgment, other people will experience you as having empathy, and you will understand other people as they are to themselves. That's huge. The third A is called the action step. And in that, it means like when you get reactive to something, it always relates to your basic structure and what your adaptive strategy is when it's feeling threatened. You need to be able to pause and notice and you know, just do the inquiry, like, what's this all about? Why am I upset? What is this? Does this relate back to my type? Is this my old type structure work with me? And if so, is it any big deal any longer? May I just let go and let God, so to speak, let go and just on myself to come back to the present moment and move forward? And if some other outer action is necessary for conscious conduct, you can come back with respect and regard for yourself and the other. So The action step involves being able to pause, do an inquiry to discern what this is all about, and then being able to take conscious conduct. The last of the four A's is called adherence. And it means, like in anything where we're really going to change and develop, we have to keep practicing. We need to make it our daily practice to keep working on our life structure. I like to say that the most important thing to me is that, and I think to us human beings, but it's my belief, is to become a more whole human being, more compassionate, more thoughtful, more understanding, more aware, more observant. I think that's what life is about, and the world sure does need more of that.
Mm-hmm. And let's see, did you talk about these four A's in your book?
Yes, the four A's are in the book.
Okay.
The awareness, the acceptance, the action. Yeah.
Okay. I actually read it a few weeks ago, so I didn't quite remember. So can you describe the process of how a person figures out what type they are?
Right. Well, we have a validated user-friendly test in the Essential Enneagram. It's a little paragraph test, not a whole series of questions, just a little paragraph test. And you pick out the three that you most like you, and then you go to a process to the type description pages, and you see which your three are, and then you go to type descriptions and sort that out. You look for the common adjectives that are in there if that's your type. And then you look at your alternate types, and there's a whole section on key differentiators. It's very user-friendly, and it's all about self-discovery.
Mm-hmm.
You feel it's most important that people discover for themselves and not be told what they are, because it's the self-discovery that leads you to greater awareness and sets you on the path of further self-development.
Mm. Well,
the organization of this is really quite good, and it's... like you say, it's user-friendly because, you know, when you stand aside and look at this and think, oh, I can never do that, I can never figure all this out, but then you start looking at this book and lo and behold, yeah, I think I can.
Yeah, I enjoyed it, and I concluded that I wasn't the type that I first thought I would be. So it was a very...
Self-discovery, journey of self-discovery.
Process. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, sometimes it's a no-brainer for me. I'm a type 6 on the Enneagram called Loyal Skeptic. That was a no-brainer to me. I always knew that I'd had some fear and some doubt and some skepticism about things and what could you trust and count on, because it's the type that believes that this is a world that's unpredictable and hazardous, and you better, you know, seek certainty in this hazardous world in order to get any security and the other basic needs met.
Mm-hmm.
You try to be yourself a trustworthy person and a good friend to people. They're more likely then to not betray you. But you can also be overly doubtful and fearful as a type 6.
Mm-hmm.
But what helps the type 6, like myself, would be to notice that preoccupation with hazard and with things you don't think you can count on, and the over-imagination that can come up and build up and kind of magnify. Little dangers can become big dangers in your mind and you don't know it.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to be able to relax back from that and really look at what's already all right and become your own authority and develop greater trust in yourself and others. That's been my path.
Mm-hmm.
Made a huge difference in our relationships, especially with my sweetie. We've been together now over 50 years. So.
Wow, congratulations.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. What this reminds me of in mainstream psychology is the idea of getting professional help to understand and identify your core beliefs, the ones that are
exactly.
Very subconscious. And so this is a system of self-help where you can look at the patterns of personality and it articulates for you what those core unconscious beliefs probably are.
Exactly. And you can discover them, and that's where the Enneagram comes in. You know, that action step, that's the Enneagram's power. The other three steps, actually, the awareness piece and the acceptance piece, the receptivity and that non-judgment, and the adherence or practice, whether it's prayer or meditation or whatever, reflection, those are in all the world's great traditions, whether it's Judaism or Christianity or Muslim or Hindu or whatever. All those other three A's are there. They're universals. But where the Enneagram comes in is in this action step, because it's hugely efficient at getting to the core of what's basically motivating you and getting liberated from old, no longer true beliefs. So for me, as this little kid, you know, it was a hazardous world. I really believed that, and so I felt like I had to seek certainty and see what I could trust and not. And now what happens is that 90% of the time when that happens for me, I mean, it's just so much old stuff, it's not true whatsoever any longer.
Right. And I like the concept that we don't have to beat ourselves up for having developed these patterns because they served a good function.
Absolutely.
At first, when we developed
them. A little kid doing the best they could with what they understood about the world, given their environmental situation, to make it an adaptive. That's why I call it an adaptive strategy. It's more than a coping strategy. It's how to really get to a life that's not only assures survival but brings satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get there.
Mm-hmm. Well, can you explain, I never fully understood from the book, what the wing types are and the security types and the stress types.
Right. Well, it's a little hard to go into all that. First of all, the basic statement to understand is it's a dynamic system. You're not just one way all the time. We do have variations within us. And when we're in more stress, we tend to adopt the strategy of a connect one of the other types. And it's a predictable strategy. And when we're really, really relaxed or secure, we tend to go into the higher qualities of one of the other types. So there's a dynamic relationship, but there's always this core inner structure of our type. So there's a great deal of variation. We teach in the narrative tradition. We have panels of people, and we teach of the types. So we can show all the variation and also show what's common amongst the particular participants of the type. The wings mean the points that are adjacent to you on the Enneagram figure. And again, they can be influences or not much of an influence. We usually have at least one or two other types that are quite influencing our own lives.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting. That
big system with interconnections to it.
The symbol, the Enneagram symbol I was reading online may have roots as far back as Pythagoras.
Yes, exactly. And that's what I mean. I think it comes from evolution. And so the early peoples, you know, had some idea of the different types. And I think this complex, you know, structure of the human mind, I mean, there's 100 billion neurons up there to begin with. And all these dendrites, we needed different functions to make a community work. We needed people that could be assertive and aggressive and move forward. We needed people that could challenge things and be successful and perform. We needed people that could be focused on giving. And we needed people like that perfectionist to, you know, help the world do the right thing. And we needed somebody to have a lot of emotion and depth of feeling. And we need somebody to be able to be more observant and stand back. And somebody that could be like me and see what could go wrong so you could prevent it from going wrong. And people who would just keep life up and flowing could always see the positive. So we needed people that could just really go along and get along, what we call the mediator or type 9, that could see everybody else's point of view and didn't have a big agenda for themselves and could just, you know, help the whole community with conflict. I think that these types then all together help build the essential whole for a community.
That's a nice perspective. Yeah. So even though we develop the personality traits as adaptive strategies in response to stressful environments, in the end, it's woven together to make us stronger in our differences.
That's right. That's right. And every type has a huge number of strengths that it offers. My partner of all these years is a mediator, and she always brought a steadiness. Reliability. We've always loved each other and cared about each other's well-being, but she was always there and present. She could understand me, and she was so steady and loving that I had to face my own difficulty trusting in things and even trusting that she loved me, you know, crazy. But that was my doubting habit of mind, and if some little piece of her wasn't loving, guess where my attention would go? To the piece that wasn't loving, not to the 90% that is. So it's just huge because we are these patterns. Our attention is limited. We don't see everything. And so that's why it's a liberation psychology, and it's huge. Fun to go on this process. When you have the first two A's in place, when you're just working at self-observation and receptive awareness, we call it, and non-judgment. Non-judgment is just key to all of this.
That's the problem in our world today, is that...
Absolutely. Huge. It's huge.
Right. And private agendas, personal agendas.
Well, there's a mistake a lot of us make, which most of us make, which is we think if we're not being judgmental, if we're being kind and non-judgmental, that we're just agreeing. We're going to capitulate, condone, go along with it. It doesn't mean that at all. We had a recent example in training of a nun who was a real executive of one of the orders in the church. And she had been protesting things about some of the treatment of women in the clergy and women in the different order. And she had been received a really negative thing about her, what she believed really strongly in while she was right at the training. It was very upsetting to her. As a type one, you know, she had to come back from the non-judgment and to be as centered and grounded as she could be in acceptance, but that did not mean agreement, and to stand up for herself from a position of non-judgment, which would give a much greater chance of her being accepted and not just coming on, you know, opposing the other people, and in her personality structure as a type one, you know, creating more conflict and more disagreement and being discounted. When we're really receptive and we're really present, it's hard to be discounted. So she embarked upon a strategy, an internal strategy, a developmental strategy of staying as grounded and present as she could and working with her own judgmental mind so that she could present her whole case in the most convincing and most compelling format.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I understand that this has been scientifically studied. Has there been studies done where you work at Stanford?
Well, I'm just on the clinical faculty. I'm not there at Stanford all the time, but it's been a big part of my life. Mm-hmm. There are studies going on. When new things come on board, and it's just been in the modern psychology since the 1970s, that's very little time. We've done studies and work. We now have a paper that we hope to be published in American Psychologist on the Enneagram system and how it relates to our neurobiology. It's just huge the way it relates to our neurobiology, the way our nerves function, the little, you know, interwoven patterns of the flow of information and energy. That's the way our neurons operate, and that's what the Enneagram is about. And it's always been there that way.
Because we didn't always have
it. We're also doing a study on how it affects development and a long-term study on that. And there's a number of studies now appearing in different psychology programs. So it's working its way into the mainstream and gaining some validity.
Mm-hmm. Because we didn't have all the scientific things
there is,
before.
But there's, you know, there's also, we teach in this narrative tradition, which is basically empiricism. We interview people for themselves. That's empirical data right out there. We do the inquiry process. There's a science in that alone. I'm not telling you what you are. You're telling me, and we're exploring. We're like people on an exploring journey together.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to KRUU 100.1 FM in Fairfield, Iowa, and this is Writer's Voices, and we're speaking with Dr. David Daniels about his book, The Essential Enneagram. Dr. Daniels, is there a section that you might like to read from the book?
Well, I could, you know, just read you the little one page. It's one of the things that we did about this book. We're going like, what would people read? So the book is just a little over 100 pages, 120 pages.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to make it user-friendly. We wanted to make it inexpensive. We wanted to make it so, you know, if you discovered the Enneagram and you wanted to give it to your friend, you could give, you know, this kind of book to them that people would actually look at and could really discover themselves. I'm going to just read, if I can, let me just read one of the reviews that one of the senior people in the Enneagram world wrote. Is that okay?
Yeah, great.
Sure.
And I'll read a little from the book. David's second edition of The Essential Enneagram is a true gem, as he takes his insights about the Enneagram and his ability to integrate the best theory and the most useful practices to a new level. Everything's in here. The three centers of intelligence, the Enneagram subtypes, highly refined information on the nine types, and type-specific psychological and spiritual practices. The first edition is excellent. This one has brilliance. So we've been getting really favorable responses to the book. But I can read the page on describing the Enneagram. You know, we wanted to do it in a page so that it didn't have to be something that people would go on and on and on to find.
Mm-hmm.
Right page. I thought I had it all marked. But
I believe page 2.
I'll get it.
Is it page 2? Is that what he's looking for?
Yeah. Uh-huh. What is the essential Enneagram?
Yeah, what is the essential Enneagram? The Enneagram is a powerful and dynamic personality system that describes 9 distinct and fundamentally different patterns of thinking, feeling, and acting. Here, Ennea is Greek for 9, and gram means a figure or something written. Hence, the Enneagram personality system is represented by a diagram of a 9-pointed star within a circle. Each of the 9 patterns is based upon an explicit perceptual filter and associated driving emotional energy. This is congruent with the way our neurons operate according to the interwoven flow of information and energy. These patterns determine what individuals of each personality type pay attention to and how they direct their energy and behaviors. Underlying each of the 9 patterns is a basic proposition or belief about what we need in life for survival and satisfaction. Each one of us developed one of the 9 patterns to protect a specific aspect of self that felt threatened as our own personality was developing. As you discover your Enneagram personality type, you will discover more about your original whole self. You will also understand more about the unconscious motivations from which you operate. Discovering your Enneagram personality type can help you learn how to bring positive change into your life. It can help change the way you relate to yourself and others, as well as give you a greater understanding of the circumstances and issues facing you. Moreover, it can give you powerful assistance in integrating the personal and spiritual aspects of your life, integration being the linkage of differentiated elements. It's nice. You know, one of the things here is that we want to integrate the higher spiritual qualities with our personality. We don't want to get rid of the personality. And they can be integrated and make for a really whole and complete life.
Because people go through life and not realize the possibilities for expansion and understanding of one another. I think that's the real sadness of the world, really. To me.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Daniels, you were mentioning some of these considerations when you were putting the book together. What will people read? How can we keep it short and usable and easy to give as a gift? Those are all great considerations. Did you work with your publisher on those ideas?
Yes, we worked with. We had a good editor in this last edition. I had a really good person who she fell in love with the Enneagram as she was exploring it. She turned out to be a Type 2, a giver on the Enneagram, which is a type that goes out to help other people with their wants, wishes, needs, and desires, and focuses on them. So she was very focused on doing the very best she could. So it was a joy working with her.
Nice. And I noticed that your co-author, Virginia Price, is no longer with us, right?
4 years ago, and, you know, sadly she wasn't here to participate in this, you know, updated and revised new edition, but she contributed greatly, and I loved working with her. It's fun to work in a team of people because you get different perspectives. If you're just doing it all yourself, you're just owned by your own perspective, unless, of course, you're aware enough to be a little free of that. But, you know, most of the self-help books are great, but they have the perspective of the person that's writing it, and the advice may be terrible for one person and great for another.
Mm-hmm.
You're writing a self-help book that says you need to get more into your feelings. Some people are already so much in their feelings, they need to get out of their feelings. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And some people say, well, just focus on the goals and get going. Well, some people are too focused on the goals, and they need to relax from the goals.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've published other books, correct?
Well, yes. Back in after the assassination of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King, I formed a group with our residents at Stanford, and we ended up in a book called Violence and the Struggle for Existence, which was really well received. Mm. It was some time ago.
Mm-hmm. So that was co-written also. Do you prefer the mechanics of co-writing versus writing by yourself?
Well, I think I just...
Yeah, you just answered
basically,
that.
Basically, I enjoy getting the other perspective.
Yeah.
I think that's what's great about having a team, whatever the team is, you know, executive team or church team, is you get different perspectives. And when you're really respectful of everybody's different approaches, you gain a much better whole.
Mm-hmm. What were the mechanics of your collaboration process like with Virginia?
Well, we would sit down, we'd brainstorm what we wanted to do. We had a vision, which was really important, and we developed a process together, and I would lead the way often, but she would be really great at, you know, bringing in all kinds of suggestions. She was really amazingly organized person with great vision herself, so it was a pleasure. Hmm. We had very little conflict, if any, when we were working together.
Were researching and writing two separate processes, or did you have all the information in your background already?
Well, that's an interesting question. Research was, by the time I got to writing the book, I'd been already teaching the Enneagram for over 10 years.
Right.
So I'd had a huge amount of, quote, research, unquote, experience in interviewing people, doing panels with exemplars, teaching and many people. We have a school called the Enneagram Professional Training Program. It's part of our group called the Enneagram Studies in the Narrative Tradition. By the way, our website is www.enneagramworldwide.com, and Ennea is spelled Ennea.com, Enneagramworldwide.com.
Okay.
So I had a lot of empirical evidence, a lot of informal scientific evidence from this, from just plain observation, which is the basis of all scientific method.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then one has to be careful about how much of your own bias you're putting into things and trying to, again, be aware enough that you don't just put your own bias in.
Mm-hmm.
That would be hard.
It's hard to do.
Yeah, I'll bet it is.
It's really hard to do.
Sure.
Your book is very nicely organized to be used as a reference book. It's easy to flip through and find the information you're looking for.
Right.
Did you get help from the publisher? Did your publisher give you guidelines on how to organize it?
Well, they were just very responsive. I think they liked the way our plan was in the very mm-hmm. beginning. And when we came to the second edition, they wanted to keep the same plan, so did I. So we had no controversy with them, basically.
That's great.
How does the second edition differ from the first? I mean, there's more included, more, I assume, but...
Well, there's a... We put in a little section for each of the types on communication styles. We put in something I've been wanting to do forever on a myth about type, because people do stereotyping, which is horrible. That's the bane of human existence, whether you're stereotyping people on the basis of personality or the basis of race or religion or culture.
Or size.
In Palo Alto in California, you go out to dinner and you hear somebody at the table next to you going like, oh, no, she's going to marry a seven? You know, like making all kinds of judgments about this. You know, that's the epicure. Or it could be any. I mean, it could be mm-hmm. any type, anything. So
mm-hmm.
it's stereotyping is something we really want to prevent from happening.
Mm-hmm. And yet, so typing is different from stereotyping.
Yes, typing is different from stereotyping, and there's always a tendency to stereotype. And the reason that we don't want children to be typed before they get abstract thinking into place, which is about middle school age, is that a parent, no matter how loving, finds out their child is a certain type, their little 6-year, 7-year-old, and then they treat the child unconsciously or non-consciously according to their own stereotype when they don't know the whole system well enough. So we're very cautious about typing children because it just ends up in inadvertent stereotyping. Mm-hmm. So just to get back to the things in, you know, the new edition, there's the communication styles. There's a whole new section in the actions and the practices section on the universal growth process. There's the myths about type. There's the adjectives. There's updates to the whole book. So there's just a huge amount of new material, all mm-hmm. integrated into it.
Mm-hmm. Now here's an interesting question. I was talking with some friends about the interview, and back to a question I asked earlier, is there different schools of thought within the Enneagram? One of my friends asked if the Enneagram was connected with Scientology, because they use a similar word that called engram. When you have a stressful experience, it creates an engram, a kind of impression, and then you work to clear that out. And so I looked online, and it looked to me like, they might have borrowed some ideas from the Enneagram. They certainly weren't the originator of it, because it goes way back into ancient history.
And we have nothing to do with Scientology or engrams. And since I believe really strongly the Enneagram has been there throughout human evolution, mm-hmm. that other personality typologies and theories actually branch off from that. Mm-hmm. So there's no connection with Scientology.
And it's just a coincidence. It's a similar word, but it's not the same concept at all.
No.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what else have we got here? What are you working on coming in the future?
Well, we're working on I'm working on another book that goes into greater depth for what therapists and people can do in their own life. I hope that'll come out in not too many years from now. We're working also on the neurobiology of the Enneagram, which is just incredible.
That's amazing.
Let me just share with you that.
Yeah, please.
The Enneagram, one of its virtues is it recognizes the three centers of intelligence: the body center of intelligence, the heart center of intelligence, and the mind center of intelligence. And some of the types lead with one of these intelligence a little more than the others. And what this relates to in our neurobiology is amazing, because all mammals have three basic aversive emotions, and so do human beings. And when it's a body-based thing, where you're not getting what you want, when you feel it's the right thing to have in the world, you get angry. You don't want to be angry. And that relates to three of the types in the Enneagram very profoundly. And then the second, the heart center, is like little animals. Little mammals get panic if they don't have connection. And so do we get distressed. I mean, it's huge, that heart center of intelligence. You have to have connection in this world. Ultimately, life is about love. And so when you don't have this, you get distressed. And three of the types lead a little more with the heart center of intelligence. We all have these three aversive emotions. The other three types, the mental types, are trying to figure out how do you make the world secure, safe, certain. So you need to be able to understand the things. You need to practice and figure out and understand and gain a certain amount of pizzazz about how everything works. So here's the Enneagram recognizing three centers of intelligence. We all have all three of them. We tend to lead with one of the three centers of intelligence in our particular type, and it's related to the three basic things that all mammals have. They all want to be connected, they all want to get what they want, and they all want to be secure. So it's huge in the way it relates to our neurobiology, and we hope to write more on that.
That sounds so fascinating. I'd love to have you back on the show when you get that book finished.
Thank you.
That would be amazing.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Well, we didn't talk about relationships. You mentioned how the Enneagram has helped you with your relationship with your wife. So are different types more compatible with each other?
Well, that can get me upset. No, I don't think you should pick somebody on the basis of type. Pick somebody on the basis, are they willing, do they care about their own well-being and your well-being? Can they be receptive and hear you? Is there some kindness there, some commitment to making a better life and to growing and to flourishing in love? And then you just use your type to work out the difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't mean if you're whatever you are, let's say a 4, that you should never be with an 8.
Mm-hmm.
Type 8. They have numbers. The romantic should never be with, say, protector or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's not the purpose of the Enneagram, not to select or to categorize people in that way.
Mm-hmm.
There's no evidence that when any type is any better or any worse than any other type or any more healthy or less healthy than any other type. And there has been some longitudinal study on that.
Mm-hmm.
So they all of us have our strengths. We all have our challenges.
I think some theories...
We all have the capacity to upset others. And in relationship, whether it's on a team, in an organization, or whether it's in your family, or especially with your special other, it can just be huge in understanding and appreciating the differences in the other person and what their struggles are,
mm-hmm.
and to really helping to support each other in your development.
Yeah, I'm really glad that you pointed this out, because some theories try to categorize, you know, this person should not be with this person or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you really love someone and the other, you think, oh no, you know,
we're doomed.
What do we have? What are we going to do?
There's strange unseen forces that are pull us apart.
Right.
Yeah. I like what you said, that what's less important is the personality type and more important is the willingness to grow and the willingness to look at yourself.
Do a little brief review of all nine types. It would only take a couple minutes.
Oh,
yeah,
sure,
good.
Great.
Absolutely.
Our listeners would love to hear that.
Yeah, type one, I already mentioned the perfectionist. It's like, you got to be right. In order to get these basic needs met, all the types need to have that sense of worth, getting what they want, that sense of love and being connected, and that sense of being secure in the world and safe. But the perfectionist feels, I must be right and not be intrinsically utterly wrong. Imagine if you believe that everything was based upon being able to be right and you just were utterly wrong. It would be like you'd lose all those basic needs. Type 2, the giver, believes like, you've just got to be giving to everybody else. And if you're not, and if you'd be, you'd be intrinsically utterly useless if you couldn't give. The type 3, the performer, believes you've got to be successful. You've got to achieve. You've got to accomplish. You've got to focus on tasks and goals and not be intrinsically, utterly unable to do anything because you believe that you gain your love through what you do and accomplish. Type 4, the romantic, well, believes you've got to be special or ultimate. You can't be deficient in any way. And if you were totally, utterly deficient, you know, nobody would ever love you. The observer believes, well, I've got to get to be self-sufficient. That's type 5. Because people can come in and drain you. They will make too many claims upon you, or they won't nurture you. So you don't want to be utterly intrinsically depleted, because that would be the end by other people making too many claims on you. I've already covered type 6. That's me, as loyal skeptic. You know, you've got to gain certainty in this world that you can't trust, you know, and to imagine if you couldn't trust the world, to be utterly helpless and dependent would be horrible. Type 7, the epicure, said, well, you can escape all danger. You just keep life up and flowing, and, you know, you cannot be intrinsically or ultimately limited. Imagine that would just bring you down. You don't want to get sunk into some kind of suffering. You want to keep life up and flowing. And then type 8, the protector, this is a type that goes, you've got to be strong and powerful in this tough, hard world and not be utterly intrinsically powerless. And by the way, I have a good friend that said, I didn't believe that. She's this 8. And she said, I didn't think I always reacted to being powerless. Well, she gets upset even when she can't control time, she said. So if you're going over time when you're talking, she goes, she gets upset because she starts to feel like she doesn't have power anymore.
Mm-hmm.
The last, the mediator, number 9 on the Enneagram, is the one that feels that they get their importance from blending into the world and kind of forgetting about yourself, because otherwise, if you made too big a deal of yourself, you might be discovered as being utterly insignificant.
Hmm.
That's just a quick review.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's nice to read more in depth because, you know, we all have our associations with each of these words, and we think, oh, yeah, I know what a mediator is. I know what a romantic is.
Yeah.
But when we read the details...
Yes, the words are not good. You pick 3 or 4 words, and we have the adjectives in the new edition of the book. You can pick most any of them. So just mm-hmm. picking one word is not very good. Some people call the perfectionist the reformer. Some people call the performer the vader. I mean, there are different words that apply, so you can't get hooked on one word. You really need to study the book and the Enneagram system. And like I say, I think the essential Enneagram's a great way to go about it.
Mm-hmm. Just to use myself as an example, I would, just looking at the words, I would think, oh yeah, I'm a mediator. That's a prominent part of my personality. I don't really have, I'm not so much about deciding what I think about something as collecting different schools of thought. And, oh, isn't it interesting? These people think this way and these people think that way. And I love to try to use words to make one point of view understandable to the other point of view. And it's not really about my point of view. But the, but that's not the, what did you say? The mediator wants to fade into the background.
Well, it's not so much fade into the background. It's more like the child experienced, and again, some genetic factor comes into this, experience that don't make a big deal of yourself. You just got to blend in. You're not real important.
Right.
It could be so much in the family that was stressful that you needed to blend in would be one example. So you kind of forget yourself.
Right, and that's not me
at
all.
Keeping peace and harmony and not making too big a deal of yourself.
Right, and so what I notice is that a lot of the basic, you can encapsulate each type by how they feel lovable, right?
Right.
Would you say
right.
that's true? And so, while, for example, I have this strong tendency in my intellectual life to be a mediator, in my emotional life, or the way that I feel lovable, it's the opposite. It's the romantic.
Right. Well, then you'd need to, if you're trying to discover which type was your core type structure, then you'd go to the key differentiators for the romantic and the mediator. The romantic tends to reference more to themselves, and the mediator tends to reference more to other people. Otherwise, mm-hmm. they can be really quite similar. They're caring, they're mm-hmm. empathetic, they're concerned, they have emotion,
mm-hmm.
feeling, and the differentiation is that the romantic feels they have to be the special and unique person.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to blend in more, not make too big a deal of themselves.
Yeah. Well, I'm the ham.
Of
what? Those two, I'm the ham.
Okay.
Well, so what about occupation? Does discovering your type help you figure out an occupation that works for you?
If it does. Now, again, you're going to find, for instance, in research science, you're going to find some people of all the different types, but you're more likely to get more of the observer type, the seeking information and knowledge and wants to be more objective about things in life in general. Our daughter, who happens to be a type 3, the performer, was in after her postgraduate program in developmental psychology, was in research, and she just couldn't take it. There was just too much, not enough going out there in the world and making things happen.
Mm-hmm.
So she, you know, left that whole academic world and went more into the business world in terms of developmental psychology, and she now is the director of content for education.com, which is, you know, a real good website. So she's very happy with her work now. So I think it makes a big difference. You're going to find more nurses as givers.
Mm-hmm.
Probably find more teachers as givers in different types and different settings. In terms of business leadership, you'll probably find more protectors, perhaps a few more loyal skeptics, quite a few of the performers, because they're out there, assertive types, getting things done, the epicures, all of that. So you won't find an even distribution, and yes, there is a difference in what occupations are likely to be most appealing to you.
Mm-hmm. And that's so important, to get something that fits.
Exactly.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Yeah.
Too many people go through life doing something every day they really don't enjoy, and so, of course, they're unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah, and our strengths are our weaknesses, and our weaknesses are strengths, you know.
I love that. I mean, it's just opposite sides of the coin. So mm-hmm. being a 3, for example, the performer, what a strength and a fast pace, going out, accomplishing, focusing on tasks and goals, things that get done, doing it efficiently and effectively. Well, the other side of that is not paying enough attention to your feelings, not mm-hmm. pausing to hear the other person enough. You know, just moving ahead too fast, not meanly, but just moving ahead too fast and sometimes not taking in the information you really need to take in to make to go on the best course of action. So the very strength is also what's challenging to us.
Does the Enneagram system suggest for business teams that you have a team with one of each type?
No, I don't. You know, you need to have the functions there. I have a great example of that. There was this business we were consulting with, a colleague of mine, and they had 825 retail stores. And on that team were mainly real assertive types, the epicure.
Are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, go ahead.
Epicure types. This team had mainly epicures type 7. Mm-hmm. It had protectors type 8 and performers type 3, the really, really more highly aggressive types. And they were great. They were wonderful people, but they weren't paying enough attention to conservation of things, like the perfectionist could give, like, is this really the right thing to do? Or the loyal skeptics are going like, what about the problems that might come up? And so in the course of working with them, we didn't suggest they go out and get these other types. We suggested they make sure that they have people on their team representing those functions.
Mm-hmm.
That. Mm-hmm. So that's what they did, and it really worked well with them.
Huh. Great.
Do you work a lot with businesses, with various types of...
Yeah, we've worked some with businesses. I've worked a number of businesses. I think the Enneagram is really useful in personal service businesses like the hotel industry and the motel and the recreation industry.
Well, we are out of time. Thank you.
Real quickly, where can you get this book?
Yes, where can people purchase your book?
Well, you can purchase it. We have a special introductory offer on our website, enneagramworldwide.com. It's got hundreds of pages of great information. It's got a tour of the types with little video clips on it, too, and a systematic description on the site. Or you can certainly get it at Amazon and in your local bookstore.
Okay.
And it's very inexpensive. Retail is $13. Our introductory offer is just $10.
Great.
Would make a great gift. Really would.
A great Christmas gift.
Absolutely.
Yes. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm, after reading your book and having this interview, I'm much more interested in the Enneagram. And
I am too.
I plan to spend some more time with your book.
Great. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed being with you today.
Thank you. And do you have a quote for us?
I do, and I think it fits perfectly. In each life, the past may have been difficult, but the future is spotless.
Awesome. Thank you for being with us. Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.